From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It now appears that Blackwater may avoid a public examination of the event that brought the company to worldwide attention and really changed the course of the Iraq War.
Private security firm Blackwater USA succeeds in partially derailing a landmark lawsuit brought by the families of four Blackwater employees killed in Fallujah 3 years ago. The suit will now be decided behind closed doors in arbitration. Blackwater's lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Then environmentalist Paul Hawken on Blessed Unrest.
This is about the largest movement in the world and how it came into being, consisting primarily of civil society organizations that are social justice, human rights, and environmental organizations.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major victory for the Bush administration, Democrats have officially abandoned their effort to include a non-binding timetable for withdrawal from Iraq in the war spending bill. On Tuesday, Democrats said they would accept a Republican plan to fund the war through the end of September. The measure would also establish benchmarks for the Iraqi government. The Democrats made the concession after President Bush vetoed an earlier bill that included a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Democrats say they do not have enough votes to override a veto and want to avoid accusations of denying funding for U.S. troops. House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi says she may even vote against the bill because it doesn't include a timeline. As many as 120 Democrats are also expected to oppose the bill. Democratic leaders plan to divide the measure into two votes so that domestic spending is separated from war voting. The domestic provisions include a federal increase in the minimum wage. In a statement, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin said, quote, "There's been a lot of tough talk from members of Congress about wanting to end this war, but it looks like the desire for political comfort won out over real action." Meanwhile, the Hearst News Bureau is reporting the Pentagon is quietly planning to nearly double the number of combat troops in Iraq this year. A new deployment order shows plans are in place to boost the number of combat troops from 52,000 to 98,000. With support troops included, the number of U.S. troops in Iraq could top 200,000 by the end of the year. Thousands of people have fled a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, where a ceasefire between Lebanese troops and Islamic militants has taken hold. Residents have been trapped as Lebanese forces shelled the Nahr al-Barad camp in a battle with the group Fatah al-Islam. At least 80 people have died, with dozens more wounded since Sunday. An unknown number of civilians are feared buried beneath the rubble. A UN relief convoy was forced to turn back after coming under fire. The situation in the camp is said to be dire and worsening. This is an unidentified resident.
We need water. We need to eat. Look at the children. Please, God keep you. Our house was destroyed. Have mercy on us. May God have mercy on you.
In the United States, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice continued to voice support for the Lebanese government.
Being against a very tough extremist foe, but Lebanon is doing the right thing to try to protect its population and to assert its sovereignty, and so we are very supportive of the senior government and what it's trying to do.
Meanwhile, in the occupied territories, a truce between the two main Palestinian factions continues to hold after days of fighting that left at least 50 people dead. Israel's continued to carry out airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. On Tuesday, several people were injured in an Israeli attack on northern Gaza. Children were reported among the wounded. Around two dozen Palestinians were also detained in Israeli raids on the West Bank. The Senate's rejected the first major challenge to the bipartisan immigration deal reached last week. On Tuesday, senators voted down an amendment that would have eliminated a controversial guest worker program. The program would grant temporary residence to up to 600,000 foreign workers, but bar them from the U.S. at the end of their permits. Critics say the plan would decrease wages and create a new underclass of workers. Meanwhile, in Mexico, workers' rights advocates criticize the new legislation. This is human rights activist Edgar Cortez.
The conditions that cause migration are still there. Migration will continue to exist. More people will consider that option, and for them, the conditions will be worse. A more restrictive policy by the U.S. could possibly result in more human rights violations, more risks and costs.
The top Democrat and Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee are accusing Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez of, quote, consistent stonewalling and misdirection about the administration's warrantless spy program. On Tuesday, Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy of Vermont and Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania set a deadline of June 5th for Gonzalez to turn over key documents. The senators say they're prepared to block legislation reauthorizing the spy program if Gonzalez fails to comply. Meanwhile, Gonzalez remains under scrutiny for his role in the firing of the 9 U.S. attorneys. Former Gonzalez aide and White House liaison Monica Goodling is set to testify before the House Judiciary Committee later today. ABC News is reporting the White House has approved a covert CIA program to destabilize the Iranian government. The plan is said to include a coordinated effort of propaganda, disinformation, and interference with Iran's currency and financial dealings. The news comes as the U.S. is engaging in its largest daytime assembly of warships in the Gulf since the invasion of Iraq. Earlier today, 9 U.S. warships carrying 17,000 service members entered the waters off Iran's coast. Family, friends, and colleagues of a prominent American scholar imprisoned in Iran are appealing for her release. Hala Esfandiari was imprisoned in Iran May 8th after more than 4 months under virtual house arrest. She's the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Esfandiari is a dual U.S. and Iranian citizen. She went to Iran last year to take care of her 93-year-old mother. This is former Congress member and Wilson Center director Lee Hamilton.
The Wilson Center's plea to the Iranian government is simple. Let Hala go. Let her return to her husband, her family, and her work.
In Russia, a former KGB agent has denied British allegations of murdering the Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko. Britain is demanding the extradition of Andrei Lugovoy for Litvinenko's poisoning death. On Tuesday, Lugovoy proclaimed his innocence.
I want to stress once again that I don't consider myself guilty. Moreover, I find myself a victim. My family and I came under radioactive attack while in Britain. I have already said this once, and I am repeating it firmly and with all responsibility. I find the charges inadequate and groundless.
The British government said Andrei Lugovoy met with Litvinenko at the London hotel only hours before Litvinenko became ill with polonium-210 poisoning. Litvinenko was a former spy and prominent critic of the Russian government. This is British prosecutor Ken MacDonald.
I have today concluded that the evidence sent to us by the police is sufficient to charge Andrei Lugovoy with the murder of Alexander Litvinenko by deliberate poisoning. I have further concluded that the prosecution of this case would clearly be in the public interest. In those circumstances, I've instructed CPS lawyers to take immediate steps to seek the early extradition of Andrei Lugovoy from Russia to the United Kingdom, so that he may be charged here with murder and brought swiftly before a court in London to be prosecuted for this extraordinarily grave crime.
The Russian Prosecutor General's office says it won't turn Lugovoy over to Britain to be tried. In Peru, dozens of countries are meeting in Lima this week to sign a declaration banning the use of cluster bombs. The declaration came out of a conference in Norway earlier this year. The U.S. is among several leading nations that have refused to attend. This is Cluster Munitions Coalition Coordinator Thomas Nash.
We think it's a shame that countries like Brazil, the U.S., China, and Russia don't come to the conference. They are countries that produce and use cluster bombs, but I hope this process has an influence on them.
And finally, in military news, a Marine officer says he's being punished for publishing an editorial supporting the right of gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military. Captain Josh Gibbs published the article in the Marine Corps Times last month. Just 1 week later, Gibbs was told he was being relieved of duty due to a loss of confidence from his commanding officers. Gibbs will be reassigned to a U.S. base in Japan, after which he plans to end his service. He said, quote, I'm standing up for what I think is right. If I want to make a change, I need to be someplace else. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A landmark lawsuit whose outcome could have wide-ranging implications and issues of accountability for the entire private military industry has been partially derailed. At the center of it all is the private security firm Blackwater USA. The lawsuit was brought by the families of four Blackwater employees killed in Iraq 3 years ago. The four men died in a convoy ambush in March of 2004 in the city of Fallujah. After being shot, the men's bodies were dragged through the streets and mutilated. Two of the corpses were strung from a bridge. The lawsuit says Blackwater broke its contractual obligations to the four men by sending them into hostile territory unprepared, namely in unarmored vehicles and without automatic weapons or a rear gunner. Blackwater appealed the case unsuccessfully all the way to the Supreme Court, but this week, a federal judge ordered the lawsuit to be decided behind closed doors in arbitration. This will allow Blackwater to avoid public examination of its practices in Iraq, and the outcome of the arbitration will be confidential. The news was first reported by the Virginian Pilot. The paper reports one of the three arbitrators could be William Webster, who served as head of the FBI and CIA under President Reagan and has personal and business ties to several Blackwater lawyers. Bill Sizemore is an investigative reporter with the Virginian Pilot. He was a finalist for the 2006 Pulitzer Prize in explanatory reporting for his coverage of Blackwater. He joins me from Norfolk, Virginia. Here in our Firehouse studio, Jeremy Scahill, author of the New York Times bestseller Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy's a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute and correspondent for Democracy Now! He testified 2 weeks ago before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense at a hearing on defense contracting. We invited Blackwater USA on the program, but they did not respond to our request. Bill Sizemore, let's begin with you. Explain exactly what has happened to the Blackwater lawsuit.
Well, this is a pretty major development, Amy. It's 2.5 years now since this lawsuit was filed. Blackwater has been fighting it every step of the way. They even hired Ken Starr, the Clinton prosecutor, to argue before the Supreme Court. They were trying to get it moved from state court to federal court. They failed in that effort. But now they appear to have found another way to derail this case. This federal judge in North Carolina last week ruled that the lawsuit is barred by the contract that these four men signed with Blackwater. This is an 18-page document in which they gave up all kinds of rights, including the right to sue Blackwater. The contract provides that in the event of any dispute with Blackwater, they have to go to arbitration, which is, of course, a non-judicial process. It has a number of advantages for Blackwater. There is no right to a trial by jury. The verdict is final and binding. There's no appeal. There's no right to discovery, which means, you know, the plaintiffs don't have the same access to internal documents, Blackwater documents. And not least, as you mentioned, it all goes on behind closed doors. The proceedings are confidential. The outcome is confidential. Actually, this is the reason that this process is chosen in a lot of cases to keep the proceedings private.
Jeremy Scahill, the significance of this.
Well, this is not just a case about one company, and it's not just a case about this lawsuit. We have to remember that when those four men were killed in Fallujah, dragged through the street, strung up from a bridge, the Bush administration responded by laying siege to the Iraqi city of Fallujah, carrying out some incredible 37,000 airstrikes. Hundreds of people were killed. Thousands were displaced from their homes. In many ways, it was the week that the war turned and that the anti-occupation resistance exploded. And so examining this incident that would prove so definitive in the course of the Iraq War becomes much greater than just the lawsuit itself. And what always has been at the center of this case is, what was the truth of the matter? What happened there? This wasn't a retaliatory strike against these four families. They spent months trying to get Blackwater to be straight with them on how their loved ones ended up in the city of Fallujah, a place where the U.S. military wouldn't even go, not to mention without an armored vehicle and heavy backup. And the families say that they filed the lawsuit only after Blackwater refused to be transparent with them. I mean, what has happened is that since this lawsuit was filed in January of 2005, Blackwater has enlisted a high-power team of very well-connected lawyers. Originally, the lawyer on the case was Fred Fielding, who now is President Bush's White House counsel. As Bill said, more recently, it's been Ken Starr. And what's interesting is that Blackwater hasn't made much of disputing the specific allegations of the lawsuit. Instead, they've sort of taken a legal tactic that says, we can't be sued. Blackwater's made this argument that the company, because it's a part of the U.S. total force, the U.S. war machine, should be entitled to the same immunity from civilian litigation for wrongful death enjoyed by the U.S. military. At the same time, Blackwater's high-powered lobbyists and PR specialists from, at the time, it was the Alexander Strategy Group, the Republican lobbying firm founded and staffed by former senior staffers of Tom DeLay, they were in the media waxing poetic about how it would be inappropriate to apply the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the court-martial system, to Blackwater operatives because they're civilians. And so now Blackwater failed to get the case removed from state court, where it was originally brought, and into federal court. They failed to get it thrown out entirely. They twice were rejected by the Supreme Court. And so now they go to a senior judge, who doesn't even sit 5 days a week, I understand, in the Northern District of North Carolina, and they get him to order the case into arbitration. This really appears to be some incredible 11th-hour legal maneuvering on the part of Blackwater's very high-powered legal team, and it raises serious questions about jurisdictional issues. I mean, a federal judge going in and snatching a case out of state court and sending it into arbitration raises a lot of serious questions. The other thing that hasn't been reported on this is that the family's lawyers have been trying to depose a number of witnesses who worked for Blackwater that they believe will be able to bring forward information that will show that there are questionable activities that took place in the days leading up to those four men being killed in Fallujah. Last Christmas, Blackwater successfully appealed to the U.S. attorney to effectively step in and block a deposition of a former Blackwater manager. And the reason that Blackwater was able to do that is they said that it could potentially jeopardize national security, that this former Blackwater employee potentially was in possession of information that, if it was revealed publicly, could damage the national security of the United States. Well, just as this judge was ordering it into arbitration, the U.S. Army and the U.S. District Attorney determined that wasn't the case, and so the deposition theoretically could have gone forward. Now, as Bill said, it's been removed to a venue where such depositions won't take place. And the other thing that we have to say here is that Congress has been investigating this issue. And when Henry Waxman asked Blackwater's lawyer, Andy Howell, to hand over some key documents, Andy Howell sort of stuttered on it and said the company would have to get back to him. If this case goes into arbitration, the odds are overwhelmingly that it will not be open to the public, a lot of the materials that would come out on this crucial incident will forever be locked away. And so the stakes are very, very high here and has everything to do with what's happened in Iraq since that incident took place.
Bill Sizemore, the arbitration panel, William Webster, former CIA and FBI director, he is one of them?
That's right. He's one of the three.
His significance?
Well, he was challenged unsuccessfully by the plaintiffs because of his connections to Blackwater. On his disclosure form that he filed, he mentioned that his law firm has business relationships with three of Blackwater's law firms. He is personally and professionally acquainted with a couple of the high-profile lawyers that Blackwater has employed, including Kenneth Starr and Fred Fielding. He also sits on a corporate board with Joseph Schmitz, who is the chief operating officer and general counsel of Blackwater's parent company. But as I say, the challenge was unsuccessful. It appears that he is going to be allowed to sit on this three-man panel.
Jeremy Scahill.
Just to clarify something here, and Bill is well aware of this, but this is kind of the muckety-muck of this situation. This panel was a panel that was created at Blackwater's request. Essentially what happened is that late last year, Blackwater filed a counterclaim against the ancillary administrator of the estates of these four men, Wes Badalona, Mike Teague, Jerry Zavko, and Scott Halvenston. And Blackwater sought $10 million in damages. Now, it still remains unclear, is Blackwater individually suing this lawyer, Richard Norden, or are they suing Richard Norden in his capacity as the administrator of the four estates? So Blackwater goes and they ask for an arbitration panel. And they ask for a panel to consist of this. The three arbitrators should be knowledgeable in both military and government contract law, preferably with personal battlefield experience. And so that's how you get William Webster. And then originally William Sessions, the former head of the FBI, was one of the panelists, but he was disqualified. My understanding is that his law firm had done some work for Blackwater, and so he was disqualified. So this was the panel that Blackwater sought out and got for this case against this lawyer who representing the four estates. Blackwater, one can assume, is going to try to get these two cases joined together so that this will also be the panel, William Webster's panel, that hears the wrongful death case in arbitration. And that's going to be a battle that's going to unfold in the next, it could unfold this week or certainly in the coming weeks. What I would imagine, I mean, the lawyers, the family's lawyers are not speaking publicly about this, but what I would imagine could take place is that they would challenge that and say, you know, we're filing our own claim for arbitration and we want a more impartial panel.
Can you talk more about the former director of the CIA and FBI under Reagan, William Webster, and his links to Blackwater, since he wasn't disqualified?
Right. I mean, first of all, he serves on a corporate board, as Bill said, this company called Single Point with Joseph Schmitz, who's one of the key people now at Blackwater's parent company, the Prince Group. The other thing that I find curious is that he didn't disclose that when he was director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Kofor Black was a major figure at the CIA. Kofor Black has been the vice chairman of Blackwater. He was the man who led the hunt for Osama bin Laden, a major CIA heavy hitter. And to my knowledge, that didn't come out on William Webster's disclosure form. This is a very small world of people that operate in that Central Intelligence Agency circle, particularly when you're talking about people who rise to the ranks of director of Central Intelligence or director of the Counterterrorism Center. And I find it curious that that relationship with Kofor Black apparently wasn't relevant to the panel.
Kofor Black, a top official in Blackwater, also one of the heads of a spinoff, and he has a new position as well.
Right. I mean, Kofor Black, just to remind people, was the man who stood before Congress and said there's a before 9/11 and an after 9/11, and after 9/11 the gloves come off. He was a key figure in the Extraordinary Rendition Program, the government-sanctioned kidnap and torture program where prisoners like Maher Arar are sent to third country hellholes to be tortured. He's now a major figure at Blackwater USA. He's been the vice chairman of the company. He's now one of the key people behind a new privatized intelligence company called Total Intelligence Solutions that's being bankrolled by Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater. Another figure from Blackwater involved with that is Robert Richer, the former deputy director of operations at the Central Intelligence Agency, Enrique Rick Prado. And Kofor Black, more recently, Amy, has been tapped by Mitt Romney, who now is leading the GOP field in the Iowa polls. Mitt Romney has tapped him as a senior advisor on counterterrorism. So, I mean, what a tangled web we weave. But I find it's very interesting that William Webster didn't find it relevant to disclose that he was head of the CIA when Kofor Black was a major figure at the agency.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And we're talking to Bill Sizemore, investigative reporter for the Virginian Pilot. He's in Norfolk, Virginia. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, miss a war,
that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. And it's a war that until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality.
War, Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, author of the New York Times bestseller, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, Democracy Now! Correspondent, Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute, and Bill Sizemore, investigative reporter for the Virginian Pilot, one of three finalists nominated for the 2006 Pulitzer Prize in Explanatory Reporting for his coverage of Blackwater. Bill, as you talk to us from Norfolk, Virginia, can you talk about this other case where a Blackwater employee is being sued?
Yes, actually, there's a development going on today in that case. Blackwater is being sued by the families of three U.S. servicemen, soldiers, who were killed in a plane crash in Afghanistan in November of 2004. This was a plane operated by Blackwater's aviation affiliate. All six people aboard died, the three civilian crewmen and the three soldiers. And there are a lot of parallels. The circumstances of the case are different from the Fallujah case, but one thing that is quite similar is Blackwater's defense. You referred to it earlier. They are using the sovereign immunity defense. They are saying that private contractors have now become such an integral part of the U.S. fighting force that they are essentially indistinguishable from the U.S. military. And they, Blackwater, should therefore be held immune from liability for casualties on the battlefield in the same way that the government is immune from lawsuit by soldiers. This is a long-established legal principle called sovereign immunity. They are using that same defense in this Afghanistan plane crash case, and they are actually in federal appeals court in Miami today trying to get that case thrown out. They're arguing before a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit in Miami. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
And also, Bill Sizemore, you have written about the Blackwater employee who Blackwater is suing over exposing trade secrets.
Yes, they're in court all over the place. This is a case where they are suing a former employee, a man that they fired, for giving away trade secrets. He was a cost analyst for the company. They say that he gave away cost modeling data, which was used in bidding for government contracts. He was fired by the company and now works for one of their competitors, a small startup company based in Northern Virginia. It's an interesting case. It goes beyond your normal corporate trade secrets case in some ways, and it sort of reflects the culture of these private military companies. This man claims that Blackwater actually has an affidavit from him in which he admits giving away trade secrets. He says that that statement was induced under duress, that he was essentially shut up in a room, a conference room at Blackwater, and not allowed to leave until he signed the statement. He says that he accuses the one of the Blackwater executives, who was a former Navy SEAL, of making threatening moves, of sitting very close and leaning in and pressuring him.
Well, Bill, we're going to have to leave it there because I know we're going to lose the Norfolk satellite. Bill Sizemore, investigative reporter for the Virginian Pilot, again, one of the three finalists for the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Blackwater. Jeremy Scahill, if you could take it from there on those two cases, just elaborate.
Well, as Bill said, with this Afghanistan case, I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens today. But these are two; these are perhaps the two major cases involving well-known war contractors in the not only the so-called global war on terror, but the invasion and occupation of Iraq. I mean, KBR, for instance, the largest war contractor in Iraq, has filed an amicus brief supporting Blackwater. I think the industry views this as the tobacco litigation of the 90s. Once that first domino goes down, it can set off a chain reaction. And in the case of the Afghanistan crash, it's not for Blackwater contractors' families that are suing. As Bill said, it's active duty U.S. soldiers. So this raises a whole slew of other issues. And very similar to the Fallujah case, Blackwater has been defeated at a number of points in this process by the federal judge who's been hearing the case. He's been very skeptical of Blackwater's arguments that they've been making. And so the stakes are very high. And as Bill said, Blackwater finds itself in courtrooms and battles around the country.
Blackwater has remained relatively quiet in the face of its critics. But last week, the company's founder, Eric Prince, wrote an article to the Grand Rapids Press in response to a series of articles in the paper on Blackwater. The paper had referred to Jeremy Scahill's book as putting Prince in the national media spotlight. I want to read some of what Eric Prince wrote. He wrote, quote, "Your story referred to Blackwater as arguably the world's most powerful private army. The Constitution does not permit the establishment of a private army, and Blackwater's team of highly motivated and capable security professionals serve at the request of the United States government. Furthermore, Blackwater professionals do not engage in offensive missions. You would be correct in calling them a team of bodyguards, but very wrong in using a description of them as a private army." Jeremy Scahill, your response.
You tell me what nation in the world has operatives deployed in nine other countries around the world, can boast of a force of 20,000 men to call on at a moment's notice, has a fleet of aircrafts. I mean, the nation of Costa Rica doesn't even have a military. So in the case of Blackwater, we're talking about a heavier force than some nation states of the world. But on the other issue about Eric Prince saying that they only engage in defensive operations, I mean, give me a break. What is more offensive than invading and occupying of a country? Blackwater's at the vanguard of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. They're protecting the people that the Bush administration has sent in to implement the White House agenda in Iraq. I mean, that is an inherently offensive operation.
In another part of the article or the letter that Eric Prince writes, he says, quote, "Clearly, the mercenary label is intended to polarize the discussion and craft the most negative image possible of Blackwater. The highest authority on rhetoric, the Oxford English Dictionary, however, defines mercenary as, quote, a professional soldier serving a foreign power." Eric Prince goes on to say, "Blackwater does not now, nor has it ever, provided security services for or on behalf of any country other than the United States of America." Jeremy, the title of your book is Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army.
I'm actually glad that Mr. Prince put forward that definition of mercenary. I mean, there's all sorts of definitions that one can apply to the term mercenary. But he says it's a professional soldier serving a foreign power. Now, according to Prince's op-ed, it would seem as though Blackwater is just this team of patriotic Americans serving their country. But the fact of the matter is that Blackwater has recruited, hired, and deployed mercenaries from countries like Colombia, Chile, Bulgaria, Poland, Fiji, the list goes on and on. In the case of Chile, this is a country whose home government is against the war in Iraq, refused to join that coalition of the willing. So the Bush administration was able to turn to Blackwater and the coalition of the billing to go in and hire up Chilean mercenaries who are professional soldiers serving a foreign power in the employ of Blackwater USA, which is a mercenary company. Blackwater's founder gives the very definition of what Blackwater does. They hire up professional soldiers and enlist them to fight on behalf of a foreign power. So according to his own definition, Blackwater engages in mercenary activities. As to the other part of it, where Eric Prince is saying that they haven't provided security services for any other country, he may be very narrowly talking about we haven't guarded a foreign official or something, but let's be clear here. Blackwater has gone in to Azerbaijan, a nation whose security forces have an atrocious human rights record. They've set up a 90-man Azerbaijani unit with a training program modeled after the U.S. Navy SEALs. They set up a command and control center in Baku, which juts out into the Caspian Sea in Azerbaijan. Blackwater has trained Jordanian attack helicopter forces. So, you know, I'm not sure how Mr. Prince is defining security here, but I would say setting up a 90-man Azerbaijani unit in a country with a very questionable human rights record, that's providing security services to another country.
Jeremy Scahill, there's other news breaking, and that is that the government watch group that monitors Iraq reconstruction programs will conduct the most sweeping review of contractors since the war began, will be auditing Blackwater.
Well, it's about time that the Congress and the federal agencies tasked with overseeing contractors step up to the plate here. I mean, we have seen this system run rampant for 4 years. We have billions of dollars in taxpayer money being given to companies who are acting in the name of the people of the United States, and there's been very little effective oversight. Now these kinds of audits, though, are going to sort of look into just the financial arrangements with these companies and the federal government. What I think needs to be audited is the activities of these kinds of armed forces on the ground. Because we know that the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction says we can't even get auditors to go to all of the reconstruction sites around the country for fear of safety. Who then is going to audit the forces acting in the name of the United States of America who are being sent to Iraq to go where no one else will go? I mean, I'm not so much concerned about the financial component of this, though it is significant, as much as I am the actions on the ground. I mean, we know that over 900 contractors have been killed in Iraq. We know that over 12,000 have been wounded. Those numbers don't get counted in the official death toll. But what's more important is we don't know the kinds of crimes that these forces are committing on the ground, what kind of suffering Iraqis are enduring at the hands of contractors. I mean, one senior-ranking U.S. military official, Brigadier General Carl Horst, deputy commander of the 3rd Infantry Division, he became so outraged with contractor misconduct that he began just tracking cases of contractor violence over a two-month period. He documented 12 instances of contractors firing at Iraqi civilians, resulting in 6 Iraqi civilian deaths and 3 injuries. That's just 2 months and one general with his eyes open. So you multiply that across the scene, and what we have in Iraq is a Wild West-type scenario. So what's urgently needed right now is for all of these companies like Blackwater that engaged in armed so-called security operations in Iraq to have their activities on the ground audited. What are they doing in Iraq in the names of the people of this country?
Jeremy Scahill is the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He has been traveling around the country giving talks about Blackwater. Jeremy, you went to the 2 sites where Blackwater has and is trying to build a base or a camp or a site, right, however you want to refer to it, and you went to Eric Prince's hometown. News Now, the planning group for the community of Potrero is under fire from residents angry about the group's support of the proposed Blackwater West military training camp. The planning group members have learned they're subject of a lawsuit, a recall drive, and a petition demanding they retake a December vote approving the project that would allow Blackwater to have a site there.
Right. I went out there to Potrero, and just to set it
in California,
to set it geographically, it's just outside, about 45 minutes outside of San Diego proper, and it's actually just a stone's throw from the U.S.-Mexico border. It's about 3 miles from Tecate, Mexico, and it's not far from Duncan Hunter's apartheid wall, and in this area of the country where there's a large military presence with Camp Pendleton, it, of course, is very near the U.S.-Mexico border, and I think Blackwater thought they were just going to quietly go into Joe Davies County, Illinois, and set up Blackwater North, and then go into Potrero, California, and set up Blackwater West. And what they experienced in Potrero, California, was an indigenous uprising from the town, population 850. It's a very rural, beautiful valley, and I saw the site. I looked down from a cliff down onto the chicken ranch that Blackwater now wants to take over. And the fact is that about half of the population of Potrero has now signed a petition against Blackwater. People allege that the planning group passed it without any real public hearing. The only notice of the hearing was in a little newsletter that's actually operated by one of the planning group members. It wasn't put into any newspaper or anything like that. It was put into a newsletter. And the fact is that Blackwater now appears to be sort of working with the planning group members to try to sort of wax the wheels of the process. Blackwater positioned its corporate yacht off the coast of California with the big Blackwater flag on it. The head of that local planning group, Gordon Hammers, went out to Moyock, North Carolina, came back saying, now that I've seen Blackwater's, you know, mother headquarters, I'm even more supportive of the project. Some of the officials in the town are wearing Blackwater USA t-shirts, and they're facing down against people wearing Stop Blackwater t-shirts. And so, as you said, there's this recall move underway. There are lawsuits. But more important is that there's a lot of knowledge now in this community of what this company is. It just started initially as a not-in-our-backyard thing. We don't want the gunfire. We don't want the traffic. Now it's turned into, do we want this corporation with all of these investigations and lawsuits coming into our community? Similar action is brewing in Joe Davies County, Illinois, where I was just out there, where you have an increased number of people. Several hundred people came in this very rural community. They thought 40 people were going to come when I came there. They had to move it to a gymnasium because so many people came. I talked to several people who are Mitt Romney supporters who said they came out because they're concerned about this company operating in their community. So we're seeing people saying we don't want secretive processes on our local level when we're talking about bringing a major war contractor into our community.
Last question about Eric Prince's hometown of Holland, Michigan. You were just there.
I had an incredibly warm welcome, very crowded events. There were a lot of people who came out to support the work. Although it's interesting, we had to hold the event in a soccer shop with a sort of indoor soccer field. And my understanding is that there were some concerns about recrimination against businesses that would have hosted me there. But three very brave souls stepped forward and opened their space. And it's interesting. I mean, people are, I think, very disturbed at the tight grip on power that the Prince family has had for so long in Holland, Michigan. And I talked with a lot of people, and I'm going to be doing some reporting on this, who had some very interesting things to say about the way in which the Prince family has controlled the local economy of Holland.
And very briefly, since we haven't discussed it in this broadcast, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, his background.
Right. Eric Prince comes from a powerhouse family in Michigan. His father was a very successful businessman who used his manufacturing company during the 70s, 80s, and 90s as a sort of cash-generating engine to fuel and fund the rise of the Republican Revolution. He gave the seed money to several of the key groups that make up the radical religious right. And, you know, this family merged together with the DeVos family, the heirs to the Amway Corporation. Eric Prince's sister married Dick DeVos, who ran for governor last year in Michigan and was defeated. These two families merged together to form one of the most incredibly powerful behind-the-scenes brokers in U.S. conservative politics and radical religious right politics. And now Eric Prince is the head of one of the most powerful private actors in the global war on terror, forces deployed in Muslim countries.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, I want to thank you for being with us, and also congratulations on your book being on the bestseller list in the New York Times week after week. It is very rare for an independent publisher to have that ranking week after week. Jeremy Scahill's book is called Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll be joined by Paul Hawken, author of Blessed Unrest. Stay with us.
I spent my whole life making somebody rich. I busted my ass for that son of a bitch. And he left me to die like a dog in a ditch. And told me I'm all used up. He used up my labor, he used up my time. He plundered my body and squandered my mind. And gave me a pension of handouts and wine. And told me I'm all used up. My kids are in hock to a god you call work, slaving their lives out for some other jerk. Yeah, my youngest in Frisco just made shipping clerk, and he don't know I'm all used up. The young people reaching for power and gold don't have respect for anything old. For pennies they're bought and for promises sold, someday they'll all be used up. They use up the oil, they use up the trees, they use up the air and they use up the sea. Well, how about you, friend, and how about me? What's left when we're all used up? I'll finish my life in this crummy hotel. It's lousy with bugs and my God, what a smell. But my plumbing still works and I'm...
The earth is not dying, it is being killed. And the people who are killing it have names and addresses. The music and words of Utah Phillips. That's one of the quotes environmentalist Paul Hawken uses in his new book, Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Paul Hawken is a best-selling author, one of the leading architects and proponents of corporate environmental reform, joining me now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's that quote from Utah Phillips heads up a chapter called We Interrupt This Program, which I think is very much what Blessed Unrest is about.
It actually starts a chapter called We Interrupt This Empire.
We Interrupt This Empire.
Which is what the empire would like to do to your program, actually. And it's really about the rights of business, or how business basically rights are unquestioned and continue to be sort of dominant in this world. The whole book really is about a rise of a movement that is a shift between a world created by and for privilege to a world created by community. And it details the rise of over 1 million organizations in the world who address civil liberties, social justice, and the environment. And even though they're atomized and there's many of them and they don't seem connected, due to modern technology, cell, texting, internet, they're starting to intertwine, morph, and come together in ways that is making it much more powerful than it has been before.
Why do you call it blessed unrest?
There was a wonderful quote from Martha Graham, and she was with Agnes DeMille, and they're both choreographers, of course, and Agnes DeMille was just really devastated by one of her shows, which had won awards on Broadway and then collapsed 6 months later, and she was bemoaning her fate to Martha Graham. And Martha Graham turned to her and said, you know, we're artists, and we're never dissatisfied. There's this queer dissatisfaction that makes us march and makes us more alive than the other, this blessed unrest. And so to me, it was a title, it was a term that had arms big enough to hold this vast and complex and diverse movement that is trying to restore justice and the environment in the world.
You talk about a turning point being the anti-corporate globalization movement and Seattle, the Battle of Seattle.
Well, it was for me. Before that, I had been interested in counting the number of actors, that is to say, the number of organizations in the world that existed, and was so doing. In Seattle, I went there, and you were there, I remember meeting, and I was there not to write. I was there actually just to sit my butt on the street, and did so. And when I left, I went back to Washington, D.C. to give a talk, and I read the Post and the New York and L.A. Times, and I was just appalled at the coverage. And the people writing about it weren't even there, Tom Friedman. They were writing about it from New York. And so I wrote a piece called N30.
November
30. Yeah, November 30. And what I was saying is that basically the economic fundamentalism had been belled, you know, the cat of economic fundamentalism had been belled in Seattle. In other words, it could no longer from that point on move or go anywhere in the world without being, in a sense, addressed by the missing stakeholders to a very anti-democratic process. But in the process of researching it, what I discovered was that the organizational methodology used, which so frustrated the Sheriff's Department, the Kings County Sheriff's Department, and the Seattle Police, was really a Mayan organizational scheme that had been first used in the Encuentras in 1992 in Quito, Ecuador, when the first peoples of North, Meso, and South America had first met since the conquest. And I realized that not only was this movement large, but there was these very interesting connections occurring across border, across culture, spreading around the world in terms of how to, in a sense, address power.
That time, the Battle of Seattle was under the Clinton era. He had to come in, fly in the middle of the night because of the massive unrest. His trade rep, Charlene Barshefsky, holed up in the hotel, but even she couldn't get away from the tear gas that was coming under her door.
Right.
This was the Clinton era.
Exactly. There's an irony to this, which I haven't told, because I had forgotten. I was on Grist, and they were talking. They said, oh, the last time we saw you is when you came into our offices shivering because you're all wet and you had been pepper sprayed and tear gassed. And I said, yeah, I remember that. And what happens, I stripped my clothes. I went into the shower, took a shower, found somebody's T-shirt, put a towel on, and the phone rang, and it was President Clinton. And he called to ask what he should say the next day when he came into town, and I was going, oh, la, 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 because pepper spray just, it freezes you, actually. It makes you so cold. And it was so interesting for him to come in, because that was really the end of this fantasy that he and Charlene Barshefsky had about American dominance. I mean, it was over in one day.
What did you tell him he should say? And did he follow your directions?
I told him to not pander, that he's been pandering, that he should tell the truth. And the fact is that it was a flawed process. And a flawed process needed to be rethought. And if it wasn't rethought, then this is going to repeat itself again and again. And that to do what his minions were doing, which is to somehow marginalize and to assign or ascribe to the motivations of the people who are acting on the street, that somehow they were, in Tom Friedman's words, you know, sort of blue-eyed activists getting their 1960s fix, was really a vast misreading of the unrest that existed in the world against trade policy.
But wasn't it more than words? I mean, President Clinton, Vice President Gore, they were the ones that championed NAFTA. They were the ones that really, with their strong-arm tactics in Congress, a Congress that would not have passed NAFTA, but offering them everything they could to their districts, ultimately won this tremendous battle for their version of what should happen with trade. So WTO followed that and, I think, built the movement.
Very much so. And it was a part of a larger Democratic Party strategy to become a centrist party that brought in business interests and therefore would marginalize the Republicans. And we saw how well that worked.
Well, what about President Bush and where he has taken this? The Clinton administration laying the groundwork and Bush taking off from there.
Well, what can you say about an administration that is basically proto-fascist? I mean, essentially what we're seeing with Blessed Unrest, what it really represents is that this rise of non-governmental organizations, and we do, again, talk about these organizations, these social benefit organizations in the negative, non-profits, non-governmental. But on the non-governmental side, there is a non-government. It's in Washington, D.C. And the rise of NGOs is to address the vacuum of leadership that exists in the world that cannot and is not addressing the salient issues of our time, which is war, which is water, which is poverty, which is climate change, which is economic inequality, and all the suffering and harm that follows from that. So the rise of NGOs is really a direct comment on the collapse of the legitimacy and the effectiveness of governments all over the world.
What about the issue of communicating with people around the world, how this movement that you call in the subtitle the largest movement in the world came into being and why no one saw it coming?
Well, one of the things we've done at my institute is we've created a website called wiserearth.org precisely to create, in a sense, an information commons for this unnamed movement that is also the fastest growing movement in the world, and where you can put in your organization, profiles, events, and so forth. And a website, Democracy Now! Or any other, can sit right on top of the data and pull it up. So that we're trying to create more or less something that feeds these NGOs and the ability for them to recognize, contact, connect, and collaborate or coalesce in different ways. That is missing right now.
You have a chapter called, did you pronounce it, Indigene?
Indigene, yes.
Talk about.
Well, I spent years reading about indigenous literature, not the literature that they wrote so much as the literature that we wrote. And to try to bridge, if you will, the gap between the Anglo or the Western understanding of indigenous culture and ours. And one of the things that really fascinated me was really the Yamana people in Patagonia, in Terra del Fuego, that have been studied and killed and bothered by so many people for so long. And this is a Neolithic tribe that went naked and had seal blubber on, that was considered to be bestial by Drake, and Darwin was so appalled by them that he considered them to be the lowest form of human life. And lo and behold, somebody came there and did a dictionary and found out that these primitive people had a vocabulary. One couple had a vocabulary that exceeded Shakespeare's by 50%, that they knew 30,000 words, which is almost close to Japanese, that they had more verbs than English, and that in this language, which was made into a dictionary, which is in the British Library, is this exquisite language of place, this exquisite language of local science, where cosmology and women's issues and science and culture were all finally and integrated into one vocabulary, one set of words, and where they have metaphors for depression, which is a crab molting its shell that hasn't come off yet. This exquisite, beautiful language, and I use that as a way to talk about the fact that there's 5,000 indigenous cultures now that are sitting on the last remaining sanctuaries of uranium, of coal, of oil, of timber, of water, and that there's an enormous move now by corporations, and I list the corporations who were basically, by disobeying the law, by corrupting governments, by paying off people, by creating false plebiscites, are going into these sanctuaries to exploit resources.
Paul Hawken, you come to this from an unusual vantage point, both as an outsider and an insider. You're an entrepreneur, you're a consultant for corporations from Monsanto on. What perspective do you have on these companies? As you say, they're looking at what they're doing now. You've talked to, you have President Clinton calling you. You're sitting with the CEOs.
Well, with respect to Monsanto, they asked me what to do, and I told them what to do, and they didn't do it.
Which was what?
Don't do GMOs. Just disaster. So I wouldn't call it a consultant so much as an opinion, advice, and they didn't take it. But in terms of CEOs, I do know them. And what I do know in the last 20 months, I don't know why they call me, because I'm very outspoken in my criticism. So for them to call me means that they're desperate. And in the last 20 to 24 months, the conversations have changed, which is, it used to be they'd call and say, how do we get this monkey off our back? How do we deal with this problem? Now they're calling and saying, what do we do about the problem? We means we. It means everybody. It doesn't mean the corporation. It means we have a problem. And there is that recognition now. And that is a big sea change. I think it's been brought about by Katrina and climate change. I think the Gore movie made it okay to talk about it. I don't think it was the cause so much as it legitimized it as a conversational thing that, white charismatic vertebrates could have in conferences with other CEOs. But I do think that there is a real change, that is, they can see the whites of the eyes of the enemy, and the enemy is themselves. And themselves is their business practices, carbon, how the supply chains, what they make, how they make it, and the future. And there is an awakening here.
You say there will be no Berlin Wall moment.
Absolutely not. We had this fantasy that somehow the powers that be can meet somewhere, agree, sign something, and that it's all going to change. But the forces that have been unleashed, the feedback loops from the environment, require participation from everybody in the world in order to make a change that's going to be effective. And we certainly need the participation of corporations, but that in itself is not enough. It's going to take all of us. It's going to be the stroke of midnight for the rest of our lives in this century. And we just have to cop to that. And that means two things. We can either separate, become more violent, we can, shrink into our bastions of ignorance. Or, like what we do in an emergency, an accident, is really reach out to other and open ourselves up and realize that the distinctions we make about what separates us are really unimportant, and what unites us are values which are universal and common and have existed here for thousands of years.
You head today from New York to the Carter Presidential Library in Atlanta. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Paul Hawken, environmentalist, entrepreneur, author. His new book is called Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. Thanks for joining us. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Bdokadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Thanks also to Becca Staley, Elizabeth Press, Kieran Krug-Meadows, John Randolph, Gillian O'Connor, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chamblee. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. You can sign up on our website for our headlines, and you can also sign up for our daily digest. Thanks for joining us.